Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is always a pleasure to have a chance to visit with smart people about the nature of that war at the moment. And one of the smartest of them, I think, is our first guest. Her name is Cheryl Chumley. She covers national security and other issues as an editor at the Washington Times. She has a distinguished career in journalism and has been a guest on this program in the past, and we're always anxious to catch up with her because she has been covering, as few others have, the challenges that we're facing in our country at the moment, notably from socialists and others who are seemingly determined to advance a similar kind of agenda, namely the collectivist, as she calls it, or communist threat to our freedoms, to our lives, and to our constitutional republic, for sure. Cheryl Chumley, it is so good to have you with us, and I really appreciate you taking the time to give us a chance to pick your brains. We'll take two segments for this purpose today about what it is we're up against and how we best confront it. Welcome back.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, indeed, the real pleasure is mine. But let's start with the impending second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump by the United States Senate that will get underway in earnest tomorrow. I kind of think of it as, this dates me, I guess, a decoder ring of a sort on the nature of the left these days. And I wanted to just sort of walk through with you some of the terms that are now in the indictment against Donald Trump and that are being used rather, well, loosely, I guess is the word for it, by both those engaged in his prosecution and partisans, mostly of the Democratic stripe, but some Republicans, it must be said, as well as many in the media, present company excepted, of course. So let me ask you about a term like incitement and what's meant by the left when they use that, well, for example, to pillory Donald Trump.
Yeah, the left is using these crazy terms now. And if you've been reading carefully the media reports on what happened on Capitol Hill, they're starting to use language like the siege on Capitol Hill, the siege of the Trump supporters against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other Democrats, and the attack.
Mob violence.
They're using, exactly. They're using language on purpose to drum up fear so they can turn that fear into condemnation against not just Donald Trump, but all Donald Trump supporters. And the reason they're doing this is because they want to chill conservative speech. They want to make sure a Donald Trump never rises again in politics, and that all the conservatives who have supported Donald Trump are so frightened at the idea of being condemned and attacked by the left that they'll just go quietly and be the good proper sheep that the Democrat Party wants them to be. And so the language in the impeachment is going to be very, very insightful, to put it the same way. It's going to purposely drive up the anger and outrage in order to completely squash free speech in this country.
And another term, which I think you'll agree has a similar intent, is insurrection. And this was, of course, alleged to be the president's purpose when he sent hordes of, domestic terrorists, as they're now being called, to sack the capital and destroy democracy. And I mean, these sound over the top, but unfortunately, they are part and parcel of this agenda, as you say, and I think this indictment. And we'll hear a lot more about it as the prosecutors present their case. But just a sanity check, Cheryl. Incitement to violence is something we saw a lot of over the summer, but it wasn't coming from Donald Trump. It was coming from many of the people who are now trying, obviously, to punish him in an ongoing way, long after he left office. It's also the case that you could say insurrection is what we saw in the cities across America, and also at the hands of domestic terrorists, notably Antifa and Black Lives Matter. Yet none of that seems to be featuring in the present drama, shall we say, or more generally, an accounting of it from the left for what they did to, no kidding, incite such violence.
Yeah, that's because the left has the media on its side for the most part. And, you know, you can't underestimate the power of the media to fuel the image that the majority of the country right now fears the rhetoric of Donald Trump because he's incited violence. First off, if you haven't read or listened to the remarks that Donald Trump delivered on that day on Capitol Hill, then you're missing the truth, because I have. And there's nothing that he said that could be by any means of logic taken to mean that he was inciting mobs to storm Capitol Hill and root out the Democrats and the socialists and demand a recounting of vote. He specifically said peaceful. He wanted peaceful marching. He wanted peaceful protesting. And this is actually what he said all along during his whole tenure as president. Whenever he spoke about resisting the left, he spoke about it doing it in terms of peace. Now counter that to Maxine Waters, the far leftist in the Democrat Party, or Nancy Pelosi, who called for the summer of resistance. You heard language coming from the Democrat Party that basically said to resist conservatives in the street, go to their homes, go to their businesses, go to their places of eating and dining, and just drive them from the public realm. And so, but the left has given them a pass. And the reason why is because, again, the media is on the left side. And in this country, words mean what the left chooses the words to mean, because the media will carry the water for them forward. And you have this image now that anyone who supported Donald Trump is angry, a KKKer, and out to kill Democratic socialists and socialists in Congress.
We have to take a short break, Cheryl. The author of Socialists Don't Sleep, Christians Must Rise or America Will Fall. Cheryl Chumley will be visiting with us for another segment about how all of this is translating into real peril for millions of Americans and for the country that they love and want to see prosper. Cheryl, stand by. We'll be right back with much more on the socialist agenda and what we best be doing about it. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Cheryl Chumley. She is an editorial writer for and the online opinion editor of the Washington Times. She's also an author, including most recently her terrific book, Socialists Don't Sleep, Christians Must Rise or Americans Will Fall. We will talk about how vitally important that point is in just a moment. But Cheryl, before we do, I just wanted to talk with you a little bit about how sort of the totalitarian left tends to operate. And it seems to me that when they target individuals or groups, for that matter, there's a certain trajectory that seems to apply inexorably. and that is it kind of starts with the practice of dehumanizing the other. And I think we've seen a fair amount of that beginning, as we were just discussing. Then it turns into a practice of stripping them of their rights, which, as you've written about so powerfully and so importantly, are God-given in our country. And then it often translates into incarceration, and in some extreme cases, even to extermination. Have I got that as a general proposition right?
Yeah, it used to be pretty much accepted by all in this country that the standard is free speech for all. And, the founders didn't put in place a First Amendment to protect inoffensive speech. It was specifically political speech and speech that could be seen as offensive. And I know that there's a lot of talk about the difference between private companies censoring speech versus government. And that's a right argument to make. But in this country, the spirit has always been for free speech and to allow dissenting opinions. And you're right, the left has taken that and they've labeled speech as dangerous. If you go back in time when they first talked about hate speech, I thought that was an egregious affront to the ideas that the founding fathers presented for protections for speech, because hate speech is not really a thing. But from that morphed all this radicalization of speech. So if you're not part of the Democrat wing, then you have limits on what you can say. But if you're part of the Democrat wing, then you can say and do whatever you want. You can take your speech and use it to attack, and then you can follow those verbal attacks with physical attacks, because in the Democrat mindset, your ends justify whatever means. Because you think you're doing the righteous thing by shutting down what you perceive as racist rhetoric, then you're quite right, not just to attack somebody, but to go after their means of income, to do bodily harm to them. And this is where the left has taken our nation. And it's sad and sorry that the younger generation is being taught that this is the proper way to exercise political dissent. And what's happening is, of course, our free speech is being completely degraded in the process.
Another freedom that I know you're very much concerned about, as am I, is our freedom of religion. And one of the leitmotifs that we're beginning to hear from the op-ed pages of the New York Times, for example, and from commentators on cable television in some cases, is the idea that there are Christian nationalists who are in the vanguard, I think they would say, of this domestic terrorism phenomenon. And it's clear that their rights as believers are now being put in jeopardy, as well as their freedom of speech and freedom of association, attending religious services and the like. Talk a little bit about how this fits into a kind of larger pattern of oppression that often is done incrementally, yes, but it seems to be now being pursued in a very aggressive fashion here in the United States.
Yeah, Christian nationalism. Everybody needs to be aware of this term that's being slung around by the left now. And your response to Christian nationalism should be, so what? Because founding fathers, in a sense, were Judeo-Christian nationalists. And all that term means is that you recognize that your individual rights come from God, not government, right? You take your moral compass from Judeo-Christian teachings, and that becomes a political compass as well. And you love your country. So Christian nationalists is another way of saying love of God and country, which if you look at, the military branches, that's what they take an oath to as well, particularly the Marines. But what the left is doing is they're floating that phrase now in order to take something that's good and honorable, to paint it black, so Christians and patriots will be afraid to speak out and self-identify as Christians and patriots. And this is very clever how the left does this. They float some language, very, very subtle language. They change the definition of the language and labeling. And so suddenly, if you don't catch it early on, suddenly these labels become something of shame and something that you should run from. So now all of a sudden, nobody wants to be regarded as a Christian or a nationalist, or it becomes a racist term. So we have to stop this rhetoric early on. We have to, when we read articles talking about Christian nationalists as if they're negatives, as if they have no business being in this country, we have to stand up and be bold enough to say, I'm a Christian, I'm a nationalist, what's wrong with that? And that's the only way to nip this clever, evil genius of the left in the bud. We have to stop it when it's the language, because what happens is they'll take this language, they'll sell it in the minds of American citizens as a negative, and then they'll use that negative to push forward an agenda with regulation and policy attached to it, where they can then attack churches, they can then attack organizations that are patriotic in tone.
And it does seem, again, if the pattern of Marxist takeovers is being followed here, as I think it is, Cheryl, that these steps, incremental, perhaps aggressive in some cases, are designed to, yes, intimidate and silence, but ultimately to dominate in a very un-American way, I think it's fair to say, and potentially very, very dangerous to the people who are being targeted in this fashion. So I thank you for calling this out and for your efforts to ensure that we understand how this isn't a one-off or this isn't an accidental slip of the tongue. This is part of a calculated effort to ensure that particularly those who believe in God and believe in God's role in the founding of this country and in the inalienable rights that we enjoy pursuant to our Constitution are not laid waste in this sort of rush to dominate and transform fundamentally the United States of America. You know, Cheryl, I know you haven't had a chance to see it, but I did want to just mention to our audience a fascinating, really chilling report that appeared in Time magazine last week entitled The Secret History of the Shadow Campaign That Saved the 2020 Elections. And maybe after you've had a chance to read it, we can visit again about kind of the thesis of the piece, which is that democracy was saved by people who have made it impossible to talk about election irregularities and the danger that they pose to not only, you know, the free and fair election we were supposed to have in 2020, but if they're allowed to be repeated, which is clearly the intent of the left, notably in H.R. 1, Nancy Pelosi's, you know, flagship piece of legislation, we will find there will be no free and fair elections in the future, I'm afraid. Let me ask you finally, if I can, Cheryl, just to sort of wrap this up. We are looking at a period in which violence, just last night, there were Black Lives Matter and Antifa activists in the streets of Washington threatening people eating their dinner out in the sidewalks of the country, cold as it was, of the city, rather, and you know, clashing with police. And it seems clear, particularly from Molly Ball's article in Time magazine, that this violence was a precursor to the effort to sort of intimidate people to go along with their program in the course of this election, and I think to conform now. Talk a little bit about how this violence of the radical left plays into the whole scheme of trying to accomplish the domination of the vast majority of people who don't want any part of where they want to take the country.
Yeah, they remind me of like the brown shirts or something, you know. I mean, violent people can be used as very effective tools of those who want to control and steal individuals of freedoms, because they can claim a hands-off approach, like, I don't support this, and yet at the same time, by their silence, they in effect are supporting this. What's interesting about the violence you just brought up about in Washington, D.C. with Antifa and Black Lives Matter is that it came at a time where we have U.S. military stationed in Washington, D.C., supposedly to protect Congress from uprisings, from these deplorables in the Trump camp. And yet these military could not stop the true violent offenders and the true deplorables of our nation, the Antifa types and BLM types. And so this is just yet another example of how the left is using these thugs of society to chill conservatives, to chill people who would support Trump, to chill people who would wear a MAGA hat, but they're afraid to because they don't want to be beat up by these thugs, or they don't want their homes or businesses targeted. So
true. Sure, we're hard out of time, but I do want to just say this is made all the worse by what you've just implied, is that the state is now in the hands of at least sympathizers, and they're getting away with it. We're going to come back to this with you, I hope, very soon. Cheryl Chumley, thank you for your time today, as well as your tremendously important new book, which I really commend to everybody. Socialists Don't Sleep, Christians Must Rise, or Americans Will Fall. Bless you. We'll be talking with you, I know, soon. Thank you, Cheryl, very much. Kevin Freeman joins us for a visit to the Economic War Room. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and welcome to the Economic War Room for a virtual tour of the facility with its proprietor, the great Kevin Freeman. Kevin is, of course, our duty expert here at Secure Freedom Radio on all matters involving economic warfare and much more. He is also the author of two terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and, as I've mentioned, has a television program called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman on the Blaze TV. Highly recommended to you all. You can find out more about it at economicwarroom.com. Kevin, it is so good to have you back for several reasons, one of which is a topic that we've discussed from time to time over the years, and it's always, well, freaked me out, I have to say, because you make a very persuasive case that if the dollar loses its status as the reserve currency of the world, we are in a world of hurt. And that seems to be in the offing now as a result of some recent developments with respect to Chinese cryptocurrency. Tell us about the latest, if you would.
Oh, it has been announced recently. February 4th, it's an article talking about how the digital yuan is weeks away from being launched. The IMF says that it's going to be extremely beneficial for Chinese digital currency, and apparently the U.S. institutions that at one point we'd hoped to stand against the risks of taking down the dollar seem to be now in support of China, and that one of those is the SWIFT transaction system, which is really Brussels, Belgium-based, but it makes it possible for currencies to trade around the world. The Chinese had been fearful that it would oppose them. They created their own alternative that they call CHIPS, and that those two have been battling it out, but I think with the Biden administration, it looks like SWIFT has thrown in with the Chinese, said we want to be a part of the digital yuan, and this does not look good for the dollar.
So as a practical matter, if SWIFT does throw in with the Chinese cryptocurrency, does that essentially clear the way for it to be traded internationally and perhaps become a new reserve currency, or do you anticipate the Chinese will continue to pursue other avenues to displace the dollar while their own option, you know, gains currency, if I can use that expression?
I think it's pretty much all of the above for the Chinese. They're going to look to displace the dollar wherever they can, however they can. And now they have very little opposition. The Trump administration was certainly more aware, not totally, but more aware of the risk here. The Biden administration views itself as a globalist administration. I think that's one of the main reasons that the people who supported him did support him. including the Chinese. And so I think that, yeah, the doors are open, the road is open, that they will pursue with diligence to establish theirs as a reserve alternative, and then to quickly erode the U.S. position.
Kevin Freeman, I've heard over the years that SWIFT has been a powerful tool of the United States government as it has sought to impose sanctions or otherwise restrict the economic activities or otherwise perhaps punish malefactors around the world. How is it that this entity is now seemingly doing such harm to our currency and the attendant economic prospects?
Well, SWIFT was never a fully captive American institution. It European-based, but we exerted every bit of influence, power, and authority that we could, and we forced them literally to maintain our position, and we really used the SWIFT transaction system and the threats to cut people off from it as a means of economic sanction, and it's highly effective. But I think under the Biden administration, I think that they see that they don't have to be a fully captive American institution any longer. And I think as a result that they just very quickly, after Biden came into the White House, very quickly stepped up and said, hey, we'll work with you, China. We're not your enemy. And I think that they're trying to maintain their position globally because they feel threatened by chips.
So it's not just a question of the Chinese supplanting the dollar that is now a factor in such calculations. It's that they may replace the SWIFT system itself with their alternative, eh?
Well, that's certainly what China has threatened to do, and certainly what they built the cross-border interbank payment system, or CHIPS, for.
Well, this is deeply troubling because, as you've impressed upon me and our audience over the years, Kevin, if our dollar is not the reserve currency of the world, its value will almost certainly plummet, and our ability to offset interests rates that we will need to attract capital, you know, in the form of treasury bonds and so on, is going to be very problematic, I guess is the way to put it. No.
It's going to force a debt reckoning. The fact that we can borrow money so easily as the world's best creditor, has benefited us. But if you remove the dollar's reserve currency, our credit rating goes down in the world, essentially, and people will be less likely to loan us money at cheap prices. The net result of it will be, you know, we'll be in a financial crisis, a serious financial crisis.
I think you've actually put it in terms of being so heavily exposed to repayment of interest on the debt that we will be unable to meet an awful lot of our other government obligations to national security, among other things. So this is of grave import, Kevin Freeman, and we appreciate the heads up you've been giving us about it, and pray that we will stave off this prospect for some time yet to come. Let me turn to something that you touched on a moment ago, Kevin, which ought to be very much on all of our minds, and that is the support that Joe Biden received from Communist China in this last election cycle. You were very actively involved in the immediate aftermath of the election for the following months in a wonderful project called Every Legal Vote, and it made the case pretty convincingly that there was, in fact, both abundant fraud and other forms of what I call electoral grand larceny in the 2020 election, but also that the foreign powers like Communist China, among others, were very actively involved in it. In the interval since we last spoke about this, Kevin, there have been several important developments. One was Mike Lindell's excellent two-hour documentary entitled Absolute Proof. Another shorter film by an outfit called Pure Data that I can't seem to find on the internet anymore, but hopefully it will turn up. It was very well done. And then a very powerful article in Time magazine by Molly Ball exposing what she calls a shadow campaign. Let's talk quickly about each of these and what they might mean for the impeachment trial that's going to be taking place starting tomorrow.
Well, first, in terms of the impeachment trial, the president is being accused of spouting lies that got the crowd all worked up and caused all kinds of problems. The reality of it is that if any of the things that are in Mike Lindell's video are true, and I'm no doubt many of them are, or the other video that you referenced, or even just the Time magazine article, which was written not from a pro-Trump perspective, but an anti-Trump perspective, admitting that there was a cabal of individuals. The reality of it is that there was all kinds of interference in the election, and that doesn't include what you also mentioned, which is the government documented that China was interfering in our election, foreign interference. They were interfering in multiple ways, and one of them may have been cyber hacking, which is what Mike Lindell's video talks about. The bottom line is that there was all kinds of unusual activity surrounding the election, depending on your political perspective, you know, whether you think it was beneficial or detrimental. But it doesn't change the fact that it was all kinds of interference in the election, foreign and domestic. And the bottom line of it is the president ought to be bringing this up because he was responding to that in his speech. I mean, like most people, I wished that he had immediately denounced and told people, don't go into the Capitol. I don't know that he was aware or whatever. I'm not going to get into that, but I'll say this. I heard his speech. It was not inciting a riot. And frankly, the people that are trying to make that into an impeachment after he's left office are just being purely partisan, pure hack, purely political, and it's bad for the American political process.
And Kevin, is it your view, based on everything you just said, that President Trump should bring forward as part of his defense in this impeachment trial the evidence that every legal vote had assembled, that Mike Lindell has now put in the film, that Pure Data has documented, and well, yes, even that, the campaign that Molly Ball talks about at Time magazine. Should these be the focus of a national treatment and debate, really, that has been, well, not just missing to date, but actively suppressed, including by the shadow campaign Molly Ball talks about?
Well, it's a big part of it because, you know, they're accusing him of lying about these things, and yet there's so much evidence around there that you know, there's so much smoke and evidence, and as Mike Lindell calls it, proof. It needs to be brought out into the public. The American public deserves the right to see this. They have that right. They should see it, and that should be a part of the president's case in defending himself. If this all happened, even as the Time magazine article says, then why shouldn't the president bring out and say, look, this is the circumstance in which I found myself and gave that speech? And I think that's an important point, is under what circumstance did he provide that particular speech?
Well, I agree. And you know, to the extent that they're saying this applies to the previous speeches that he made in the months after the election was over, I think it is exculpatory for sure. Also, Kevin Freeman, I think it's absolutely necessary, and you've understood this from the get-go, if there is to be a free and fair election going forward, that we understand what went wrong this time around and we do not permit it to become institutionalized down the road. Thank you, Kevin Freeman, for your time today, as well as your great expertise and all the work you do at Economic War Room. It is absolutely superb, and I hope our audience will be following you closely there and, of course, here as well. Bless you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Suzanne Schulte about an update on what on earth is going on in the Korean Peninsula and the Western Sahara. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's said that people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. In the case of Joe Biden, the principle should apply as well to people who live in white houses. President Biden says his predecessor should not have access to classified intelligence briefings, a courtesy normally extended to former commanders-in-chief. Mr. Biden's stated justification is his fear that Donald Trump, quote, might slip and say something, unquote. If anyone should be denied access to classified information, it should be Joe Biden. He's notoriously loose-lipped. He's also been deeply compromised by our nation's most dangerous adversary, the Chinese Communist Party. And President Biden has demonstrated utter contempt for the most basic of security concerns by reportedly consulting on China policy with his son Hunter, a profound counterintelligence risk given more than $1 billion by CCP operatives. Can Joe Biden really cast the first stone? This is Frank Gaffney.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and I am always delighted to be able to say a particularly warm personal welcome to a friend and colleague of many years by the name of Suzanne Schulte. She is the president of a wonderful organization, the Defense Forum Foundation. She is also very actively involved with the efforts to bring freedom to North Korea. Suzanne Schulte, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Wonderful to be with you.
So let's talk a little bit about the state of play in North Korea at the moment. There are things that I thought I would never leave to see, like the dictator of North Korea apologizing for making a hash up of the economy of his country. There also seems to be a lot more to the story about the COVID, or I call it the CCP virus, the Chinese Communist Party virus, in that long-suffering population. Talk about both of those, if you would.
Sure, sure. I find it very interesting. You can basically break it down three ways. What North Korean's saying, what is being said, and then what the facts are. North Korea claims they have no COVID. They have the best medical system in the world, and they've had the best response of anybody to the pandemic. They're refusing help from South Korea. South Korea is offering to give them vaccines, but they're refusing any help from South Korea. What is said by the WHO, WHO says the North Korea has no confirmed cases of COVID, and there's been no deaths. This is according to the WHO. But our CDC, Center for Disease Control, marks it as a level 4 country, right up there with England, with the United Kingdom, and Germany, as a level 4 being the most dangerous, highest risk of getting COVID. But that's how CDC ranks it. And but let me give you some facts. We know that North Korea was probably one of the first countries to shut down. With their border with China, they probably had the first outbreak of COVID after China, after it got out of the lab in Wuhan, because they shut their border down on January 22nd, 2020. Their border's been shut down for over a year. And we saw with our own eyes how they responded to a maritime official from South Korea. We don't know why this maritime official was approaching the maritime border of North Korea. Was he defecting? His family says absolutely not. Did he fall overboard? What was the deal? We don't know. But we do know this. The North Korean border guards shot him and burned him. I mean, this is a horrible incident, but it shows how terrified they are of COVID. And also, another statistic that's interesting, there's only been 229 escapes from North Korea in 2020. That's the lowest in 20 years. Only 229.
These are defectors trying to flee this horrific country.
And exactly.
It just suggests that the border is being very tightly controlled, presumably both with respect to people trying to get out and people trying, for heaven's sakes, to get in. Is that right?
Exactly. So it's dropped. That's the lowest in 20 years. That's how tight the borders shut down.
So what are we to make of the fact that Kim Jong-un is apologizing for the dismal state of his country, his people, his economy?
I think we're back where we were in 2009 when they were devaluing the currency and they basically had an uprising in the mostly among the people that were involved in the markets, which were women, because at that point in 2009, they had most people were relying on the markets, and they were which were created by North Korean women out of desperation to feed their families, and they devalued the currency because they were trying to reassert control over the markets because they couldn't control them. Capitalism was how people were surviving. And I think what's happening is that we're back at that same point because they've shut down the border and the people are trying to rely on these markets. They're claiming now that you can only use this North Korean won in these markets, whereas they usually use the Chinese renminbi or whatever the Chinese currency is, or the U.S. dollar. It's the same thing they were doing back then. So it seems like he's trying to reconcert control over the economy, but things are so bad there. And most of our information comes from defectors, and so there's been such a drop-off it's really hard to find know exactly what's happening. But I think that's we're back in that period where they're trying to reassert control over the economy, and things are really, really bad internally.
The government in South Korea of Moon Jae-in has been notably determined to try to help the North in various ways. Has that fallen off as well under these lockdown circumstances, Suzanne Schulte?
It's terrible what's happened in South Korea. They passed a law. Moon Jae-in pushed a law through the assembly because his party has control of the South Korean assembly that bans information being sent by balloons, by sea, by air, also bans broadcasts at the border. And it's created a huge internet. Basically, everybody has been criticizing it, from the United, even the UN, because it's limited on free speech. The special envoy for North Korea, Thomas Quintana, has criticized it, as well as Michael Kirby, who was the head of the UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korea, and also both Democrats and Republicans in our Congress have criticized it as limiting free speech. It seems to violate the South Korean's constitution and also their international treaties, because it's limiting people's ability to be able to communicate with people over in North Korea. And we know the reason why the defectors do these balloon launches is because they got leaflets. They saw the leaflets when they were in North Korea.
They were recipients.
It's a way to get... So we know you shouldn't ban any information that you can get into North Korea, because that's a method of control by the regime, is to isolate people in North Korea. So all methods of information are critical. So the Moon government is doing this at the specific request of the Kim regime, because it is an effective means of getting information in. And I'm involved with a radio program called Free North Korea Radio. Fortunately, we broadcast outside the peninsula, so they can't stop us. But we're continuing to broadcast in the morning and the evening. But it's terrible what's happening in South Korea. It's really terrible that this government is appeasing it. And here, South Korea is offering to help North Korea with vaccines, and they're saying, we don't want your help. Leave us alone. We're perfect. We got everything under control. It's terrible to see this thing play out.
It's a very, very difficult humanitarian nightmare, and nobody, I think, does more to try to alleviate it than you and the defectors with whom you work, Suzanne Schulte, and your North Korea Freedom Coalition. Bless you for all that work. We're not going to do justice to this other topic that I did want to just touch on quickly, but I know you had a strong disagreement with President Trump about another region of the world, half of the world away from the Korean Peninsula, I think it might be said. Talk about Western Sahara and why we should be concerned about what's happening there, and a mistaken policy you think the President Trump adopted, and whether Joe Biden is going to correct it.
Well, Western Sahara is the only African nation that did not get decolonized. It's the only remaining colony in Africa. It's the only African country that's occupied. I strongly disagreed with what President Trump did by Morocco, right? And they were supposed to have a referendum in 1991. They had a ceasefire. They're supposed to have a referendum on Western Sahara. It was formerly a Spanish colony of Spain. But when Spain withdrew, Morocco invaded. Even though the International Court of Justice had ruled against Morocco, Morocco was claiming that Western Sahara was part of Morocco. Well, the Sahrawis, the people of Western Sahara, disagreed strongly and wanted their country back. And so they went to war, which lasted till 1991. They're at war again, because the United Nations never held the referendum they had promised. They laid their weapons down in 1991 because they were going to get a chance to vote, which is all they ever wanted, was just a chance to vote. And that vote never happened. Morocco violated the ceasefire last November. They went back to war. And tragically, President Trump made a huge blunder, a huge mistake. He recognized Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara. And I don't know. He was so poorly advised. Senator James Inhofe was so upset, because Inhofe is a big proponent, and is also a big proponent of Trump, of why that happened, and that was in, you know, the last days of his administration. But it was a huge mistake.
Suzanne, we're going to have to stop, because this is a topic that I hope we can return to both with you and with Senator Inhofe, who's a dear friend, and see if we can't help get this right, because obviously what you've described is very troubling and in need of attention, and we hope to give it some more of it here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for joining us today, Suzanne Schulte, and all the great work that you do. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us again soon, as I hope will the rest of you. Same time, same station. Until tomorrow, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.